Whenever I introduce you to people, I like to brag to them about your amazing spiritual gift. To some it is given one, and to some it is given another, but to Brian Buchanan, it is given to connect your family tree, genealogy, and Mormon heritage and tell you which Mormon prophet you are related to. You think I'm kidding. You give this man a name and he can tell you which wagon company your people cross the plains on. Tis the stuff of legend.
All right, you're probably leaning a bit more legend than truth.
Hush. Hush. I'm trying to make a point. Let's show off your talents, Brian. No hiding it under a bushel. Let's play a game. I will tell you a random Mormon surname and you give me the lineage. You ready?
Boom. Let's do this.
Hunter.
Well, you've got several Hunter lines. You've got Jacob Hunter, who came over with Warren Foot Company in 1850, or you've got William Hunter of the John Banks Company. Which Hunter line are you talking about?
Nerd. Roundy.
Ooh, Roundy's a good Nauvoo name. All right. Also, you've got several Roundies living in the Nauvoo period. You've got Shadrach Roundy, awesome name, who had lots of kids.
Okay, show off. How about Nelson?
Which one? The William Nelson of the Nauvoo line? Or there's a ton of Scandinavian Nelson?
Okay, I've got an obscure one. This comes from my home ward. How about Greenwell?
Oh, yeah. Greenwells are interesting. Nice choice. You got a bunch of them that run around with Heber Kimball back in the day.
Ugh, Woodruff.
Dude, now you're just playing softball. Come on now.
Okay, Brannon.
Huh?
Brannon.
Who are you talking about?
Brannon. Come on, Brian. Don't let me down.
I thought you were giving me Mormon last names.
Brannon, as in Mormon leader, missionary, and pioneer Samuel Brannon?
I went to school with a Sean Brannon. Does that give me anything? I don't know who you're talking about.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Friend of the podcast, Joe Geisner, has given me a lot of good historical help over the years. One of my favorite things he's ever told me was that there were two frontier Mormon Zions. Never forget this. There is Brigham Zion, Joe says, and then there is Brannon Zion. There's a reason why Brian Buchanan doesn't know many Brannons in Utah, and we're going to get into those reasons today.
When you think of Brigham Zion and Brannon Zion, you really can't have one without the other.
You could even say one begets the other.
All right, before we get into competing Zions, first a word from our sponsors. Plural marriage in the Nauvoo era of LDS church history has long been a fascinating subject. To understand it fully requires one to look at it from the perspective of the man who introduced it, but just as crucial is a dive into the lives of the women he married, all of who have their stories to tell. In his 1997 award-winning study, In Sacred Loneliness, The Plural Wives of Joseph Smith, Todd Compton focused on the 33 women who he could demonstrate that Smith married, providing life stories of many who are well-known and others who have been largely forgotten. In his new work, In Sacred Loneliness, The Document, Compton returns to his subject and provides the raw materials that helped him create his original study, writings composed by the women themselves. This volume includes many autobiographical writings, diaries, and letters, with Compton providing annotations and introductory material that illuminates these crucial primary sources. This allows readers to take their understanding of this unique group of women to a new level and to drive home the fact that their lives go far beyond the Nauvoo experiment that forever links them to Mormonism's founding prophet. In Sacred Loneliness, The Documents by Todd Compton, new from Signature Books. Get it from Benchmark Books or wherever you get your books.
It's so good.
All right, kids, I'm going to need you to take off your nerd hats for a hot second, set them down nicely on your stack of Newell Bringhurst articles, and pick up your American history hats. In fact, if you don't have one of those, a quinine bottle full of Goldlust will do just fine, because we need to talk about the origins of California.
When one invading imperial colony and another post-liberated imperial colony fall in love, they give each other a special hug, and that's how you get a California.
Lindsay, there are children in the room. And people from Canada.
My apologies. Let's just say before California became a state in 1850, it first was in a polyamorous twist between pre-Columbian North America, Spanish colonizers, and European explorers. Most specifically, I want to talk about the Yerba Buena area, which is now known as what, Brian?
Brannon Zion?
San Francisco.
For reference, the descendants of the indigenous people that live in the Bay Area now call themselves Ohlone. Specifically, the Yellamu tribe was occupying the area for at least 5,000 years before Spanish explorers invaded.
So Spanish missionaries arrive in the Bay Area in around 1769. Shortly after, the Spanish started a little mission on the Dolores River called Mission Dolores. It soon started taking on the name Mission San Francisco de Assis. I'm such a white lady. It was really named after Saint Francis of Assisi. Am I saying that right?
You hear it Assisi, but...
Assisi?
Samsonite.
Assisi, if you're Brigham Young. The founder of the Franciscan Order. Just like the Mormons, Spanish Catholics like to dedicate things to a name, and on October 9th, 1776, they dedicated this area. Four Yellamu were allegedly converted, and the tribe ends up getting absorbed or colonized into the mission.
While Joseph Smith is being born, seeing visions, digging up some gold plates on the East Coast, on the West Coast, the mission hosted about 1,200 people in the 1820s. The mission chapel was a focal point, and Spanish and Yellamu farmed in the area around there.
Meanwhile, Mexico was having its own independence fight against Spain. So while America's going or just survived its own independence from Britain, Mexico's doing the same thing against Spain. Just like the American Revolutionary War, the Mexican War of Independence was a similar revolutionary civil war with a lot of localized battles and struggles. The war resulted in a lot of tension for the San Francisco area. Supplies and money from Spain were cut off, and guess who paid the consequences? It wasn't the Spanish, but the colonized Yellamu. They say that 5,000 souls are buried in the mission cemetery from this period. The Catholic Church separated the church's responsibility from paying for anything in the mission other than the church, and the Dolores mission really struggled. By the early 1840s, it's said that only 8 surviving Christian Yellamu resided at the mission.
Okay, so independence is won back in 1821, and that's when California became property of the first Mexican Empire. The new Mexican government didn't want any more Roman Catholic influence disrupting their very tenuous, very newly won power. So they closed down all the missions and nationalized church property. Good thing for Mexico, I guess, but not for the tribes that were forced to survive the latest fad or whim of their Spanish invaders.
So we tell you all of that because that's where San Francisco is sitting around the time the Mormons decided to leave Nauvoo, gone through its own independent struggle. There were about 21 other Spanish missions throughout the California territory that were in similar situations, and it's important to know the Spanish influence all over the West because that'll show up later for the Mormons. That's how Los Angeles and San Jose were born, when a few Spanish pueblos turned into cities after the Mexican War of Independence.
Even though war was waged and apparently won in 1821, there's going to be more to come. Mexico had just freed itself from Spain, but now they had another group coming for the property. You might have heard of him. They're the good old United States of America. So when Brigham Young is preparing several thousand people to head to Alta or Upper California, and think of Upper California as present-day San Diego, maybe Giles Martin can remaster an outtake of John Taylor singing about that in an alternate take of Upper California? Anyway, during the Mexican-American War of 1846 to 48, the Mexico lost its claim to California to the U.S.
Yes, the area of Upper California was fought over paper and contracts when the Mormons were singing and dreaming about it over in their Nauvoo meetings. And we wanted you to understand what was happening in the area when Brigham Young decided to send Sam Brannan all the way over with his 238 Mormons to colonize the area. It was a sparsely populated but barely colonized post-Spanish colony struggling with a national identity crisis.
Okay, let's get into Brannan. Who was he? How did he end up going to San Francisco with the Mormons? But before we do that, I move that the council sing a hearty verse of Upper California.
Yes, you'll have to forgive us. Actually, no. I make no apologies for this. I'm actually very excited for this. I've asked Matt Riley, a good pal of Sunstone and a regular sing whatever song is asked of him kind of guy, to lead us in the verse of Upper California, as was composed by John Taylor, because we have referenced this at least thrice on this podcast so far. Get used to it. The council brings it up every time they talk about where the Mormons shall go, so we will reference it at least as much as the Council of 50 did.
So every damn day from 1845 to 47?
Correct, and you will learn it word for word.
That's right. We tracked down the original lyrics, and then Matt researched what the tune would have sounded like. So if every single member of the Council of 50 had to hear this song sung in every meeting when they're making the plans to come west, you get to hear it too.
The Upper California, oh, that's the land for me. It lies between the mountains and the great Pacific Sea. The saints can be supported there and taste the sweets of liberty. In Upper California, oh, that's the land for me. Oh, that's the land for me. Oh, that's the land for me.
Thank you, Brother Riley. Now that we've gotten our opening song out of the way, let's get back to Brannan's expedition. Samuel Brannan. What does one say about one of the early bad boys of Mormonism? I mean, I guess we did cover him in the Bad Boys of Mormonism episode.
Nice try, lady, but we covered him in episode 45, Boston and the Case of the Kissing Wives.
Ah, that's right. But he is still a very bad boy in early Mormonism, or a very good boy, depending on your perspective. He was a close associate of Joseph Smith and trusted enough by Heavenly Father to be called as a presiding elder. Let's break out the Mormon bona fides, Brian.
All right. Samuel Brannan is born in Saco, Maine, not Saco or Saco or some other crap. He's born in 1819. Then the family moves to Painesville, Ohio when he's about 14. His father was an abusive alcoholic, and to escape that, Sam moved in with his sister while she's being taught by two Mormon elders, Heber Kimball and Orson Hyde. Brannan's brother-in-law saw the dudes preaching on a street corner in Kirtland and bought a copy of the Book of Mormon from them. That was all she wrote. The Brannans were baptized in Kirtland in 1833.
Brannan tries his hand at being a publisher, has several failed business situations, and turns his zeal to the church. But I have to say, a study of Brannan's early life, in my opinion, always has him more invested as a capitalist than as a religious Christian. Stay tuned for that. For me, Mormonism seems like just a place to keep him busy while he was down and out on his luck. After his several businesses fail, he gets married to Harriet Hatch and is called on a mission to tract around Ohio by Wilford Woodruff. But the mission doesn't really get any traction.
Ba-dum-ching.
Because Brannan comes down with the dreaded frontier malaria.
And maybe that was just the twist of fate the universe ordered, because it's then that Brannan is paired up with one William Smith, a younger and arguably the punchiest of the Smith brothers. The two start up a printing press in Connecticut, and then Brannan falls in love with another woman, Annalisa Corwin, and just ditches out on his first wife and new baby. Like a classy dad. A vintage try guy, if you will. Too soon? Or maybe too late? In 1844, the boys finally pulled off a printing press, but in New York. The publication is called The Prophet. They later call it the New York Messenger. I can't imagine that that rebrand really helped the non-Mormon subscriber numbers, however. Brannan really likes William Smith, and the two become thick as thieves. Brannan was also appointed the presiding elder in New York City on October 25th, 1844.
Now is where you should pause the episode and go listen to episode 45. Brannan and little smash brother William are up to shenanigans. Just pure chaos and spiritual wife nonsense in Boston that gets them into trouble at Church HQ in Nauvoo. Basically, they were ruling the branch out there on the East Coast with the I'm in power over here, I do whatever I want attitude, and the ladies and the money and all of it gets them both disfellowshipped.
Don't worry, in 1845, the Quorum of the Twelve reinstated Brannan in a move that Brigham Young soon regretted big time. But he was reinstated in May of 1845, so in the Quorum's defense, it's kind of a busy time. Part of the issue had to do with the fact that Brannan supported William Smith in whatever pitch William had to become the next prophet. That was part of the disfellowshipment as well, and he had to work really hard to prove to them that he was still loyal.
It seemed to work because he traveled all the way from New York to Nauvoo to beg, as historian Eugene Campbell calls, a penitent sinner, and he swears he will be a good Mormon boy from here on out. As part of that loyalty, he promises that he can help alleviate East Coast concerns and lead a group of Mormons to California by sea.
Orson Pratt approves heartily of the plan and appoints Brannan the presiding elder of 238 Mormons. The plan is to leave New York on the ship Brooklyn, go through Hawaii, which the Mormons would very soon eyeball for big-time missionary work, and then go to California from there.
Now, Brannan was shining. He was no longer tied to punchy William Smith, who was having constant tantrums with other successors and their claims. Now, Brannan has a calling as a great American frontiersman. He was only 27 at the time, and he drafted a list of rules for the men he presided over. And the rules were something of early mission rules. Prayers every evening, no matter what the weather was. Attendance was mandatory. Now, this seems pretty religious for a guy who would later break Brigham Young's heart in a big way. You're correct.
Last episode, we told you as the Council of 50 kept discussing the moving out of Nauvoo and heading west, that Brannan was working on going to explore the Upper California. It appears that as Brannan started out on this quest, though, he got some very complicated intel.
The Joseph Smith Papers Project explained the situation. Quote, as early as April 1845, Illinois Governor Thomas Ford had warned Young that the federal government might intercede to prevent the Mormons' departure, and this concern only grew with time. On the 11th of December, Young received a detailed and disturbing letter from Samuel Brannan, who had been contacted by Amos Kendall, the former Postmaster General and a well-connected Democrat Party political insider. In an attempt to extort an agreement from the Mormons to give him and the business partner fully half of all the land they would eventually settle on in the West, Kendall misrepresented to Brannan that federal intervention against the Mormons was imminent. Brannan conveyed the warning that the Secretary of War and the heads of government were determined to prevent our moving west, alleging that it is against the law for an armed body of men to go from the United States to any other government. Rather than allow the Mormons to settle to California or Oregon, Brannan reported the government would obliterate them from the face of the earth. Young responded with an effort to secure government contracts for building a line of forts or stockades en route to Oregon, but the possibility of having the way hedged up remained.
As you can see, it was a complex time for Mormons making decisions. Like Ben Park mentioned last episode, counterfeiting charges kept following the Mormons too. We mentioned that during this period, there's still lingering charges about the destruction of the Nauvoo Expositor printing press, and the counterfeiting, and you've got writs and warrants still being issued for Mormon leaders. Even though anti-Mormon groups in Illinois had made an agreement with John Hardin in October 1845 that no prosecutions would happen if the Mormons would just leave and go west, Brigham Young came under fire for counterfeiting. That December, Brigham Young is indicted by a grand jury for counterfeiting American and Mexican coins.
The local papers reported that Mormons had paid for land with wagons full of counterfeit coins. But Brigham wasn't the only leader in trouble. The grand jury issued indictments for a bunch of other Mormon leaders as well on issues of counterfeiting. We talk about counterfeiting in the Bogus Brigham episode, so definitely check that out if you're just tuning in. This is where you have federal marshals come to the Nauvoo Temple to arrest Brigham Young, so they have William Miller dress up as Brigham Young. He's our Bogus Brigham, as he'd become known for creating bogus coin. And Miller gets arrested with marshals thinking that he's Brigham Young, and they travel all the way to Carthage before they realized he wasn't actually Brigham Young. So nice job, Mormons, on the dishonesty.
Still, things were closing in on the leaders, the mischief aside. The Joseph Smith Papers folks do a good job of summarizing how it went down. Brigham and company ended up not actually being arrested, but then larger federal threats started trickling in. Our good buddy, Governor Thomas Ford, sent a letter to Mormon sympathizer, Sheriff Jacob Backenstows, that the Secretary of War was strongly considering sending some actual federal troops to Nauvoo to make sure we get some arrests going. Ford also warned that Washington was mulling whether to prevent Mormons from going west, period. We talked about why earlier. Remember, the government's concerned that the Mormons would join up with the British, who are still trying to regain a toehold out west. Apparently, the Brits wanted one more punch on their get your butt kicked by the colonies card. This all is very serious news, and it got Brigham's attention. He told William Klain to stop writing this stupid diary for 5 minutes and convene the Council of 50 in the upper story of the temple.
Yippee-yay, there'll be no wedding bells for today. 'Cause I got spurs that jingle, jangle, jingle.
Jingle, jangle. as I go riding merrily along.
Yes, things were closing in on the Mormons, which is largely why they dispatched Brannan to head west. Brannan either believed or, according to Newell Bringhurst, was made to believe that he would go to California, set up a shop, and then the rest of the saints would follow along. And that's the sort of giant misunderstanding that really screws things up for later. Let's finally get to the main event, shall we? Brannan's new mission to the Upper California and settling Brannan Zion.
Jingle jangle, they sing, oh, ain't you glad you're single?
Jingle jangle,
and that song ain't so very far from wrong.
Jingle jangle.
Meanwhile, back on the old ship Brooklyn, the boat finally takes off from New York, and they eventually dock in Honolulu. And for once, Mormons decided to not tell everyone in earshot about how great that Joseph Smith was. When they docked, they opted to tell anyone who asked what their main belief was, it was to, quote, mind one's own business. This obviously becomes the Mormon creed later on, but it was born out of necessity here. They're trying to lay low at this point instead of waving this banner unfurled like usual.
Maybe as a result of this, if local Hawaiian newspapers are to be believed, the Mormons were welcomed with a pretty friendly reception. On July 1st, 1846, the Honolulu Friend, no, not that friend, wrote, quote, "The arrival of the Brooklyn has brought to our shores a large company of immigrants on their passage from New York to California. Rumors are afloat, and numerous inquiries are made respecting the origins and sentiments of those people, and the desire has been expressed that we should furnish for the readers of the Friend some information on the subject. It cannot be expected that an extended account would appear in our columns, but we offer the following summary of information gathered from various sources."
Yeah, if anything, folks in Hawaii reading English newspapers were mostly newly arrived Protestant missionaries who knew very little about earlier Mormon conflict in French Polynesia or the tensions in Illinois because they reported stuff like this, quote, "The following summary of their articles of belief we publish upon the authority of Mr. Brannan, who is the leader of the company now bound for California. We would remark in regard to Mr. Brannan, that he is a young man, about 27 years of age, a native of Saco, Maine, a printer by trade, has resided for 3 years in the family of Joseph Smith Jr., has been editor of a weekly newspaper in New York City called the New York Messenger, and is intending to establish another paper on his arrival in California. And P.S. his first wife hates him." Okay, they probably didn't say that.
Apparently, Brannan didn't even follow his own advice in minding the Mormon business. Brannan gave a public lecture at Seaman's Chapel in Honolulu on the subject of eternal life.
Mormons are still gonna morm. Those incorrigible little scamps. They even excommunicated 4 church members while they were there. We know all this because Brannan's letter to church leaders was published in the Millennial Star. Apparently, the 4 were exed because they were, quote, "backbiters, evildoers, and guilty of wicked and licentious conduct. Pot calling kettle black, Mr. Chairman."
The group lands in San Francisco nearly 7 months after leaving New York. And this is a journey. I looked this up. They go from New York all the way down past South America, down by Antarctica, and then all the way up to Hawaii. Sounds very inconvenient.
And this is better than going overland. That's the thing.
I was just thinking, like, why don't you just cut through the Sierra Nevada? What's wrong with that? We will find out soon.
Getting hungry for my brother's leg. That's why.
So they step off the boat to the very rugged, now nearly abandoned Spanish mission. Remember, were you paying attention with your American history hats? You know all about it. It was called the Yerba Buena. The place was named by the Spanish after the Yerba Buena plant that grew there. Hopefully they liked mojitos. You know, Yerba Buena is mint. And by now, the Hudson Trading Company had barely established an outpost there, but it was so sparse that the Mormon arrival doubled the population.
The second day after they arrived, they held a church service. Onlookers that were there weren't particularly impressed with Brannan's preaching. They remarked he seemed like every other preacher they'd heard. Nothing to write home about, I guess.
Perhaps it was this precise lack of enthusiasm that led to apostasy rather quickly. Brannan didn't establish the group into a branch in spite of his earlier convictions to keep the Mormons in spiritual shape, and it wasn't long before the Mormons were absorbed into the trading company activities of land speculation, gambling, drinking, and all that stuff that a bunch of unaccompanied men on the frontier do.
Here's how Newell Bringhurst explains what happened next. Quote, "Brannan, with characteristic energy, quickly made his presence felt in this new environment. In January 1847, he established San Francisco's first newspaper, the California Star, utilizing his proven journalistic skills and, indeed, the very same press that had been used to publish the Prophet and New York Messenger. But Brannan quickly announced in his very first issue that the California Star would eschew with greatest caution everything that tends to the propagation of sectarian dogmas. In other words, the Star would not be a Mormon cheat. Brannan also conducted the first non-Catholic church service in California, performed the first white marriage, and was involved in one of the first jury trials in Northern California. He also founded the first white agricultural settlement in the fertile San Joaquin Valley. This settlement, dubbed New Hope, was established along the Stanislaus River. Oddly, New Hope was somehow the first settlement Brannon started, but somehow the fourth? That's weird. Newell describes the settlement as a, quote, Mormon cooperative community, and in the words of Brannon, designed to better prepare for the expected main Mormon migration to the Pacific Coast under the direction of Brigham Young.
That's really cute. He was really setting up the path for the Mormons to come on and join them over. We could have landed in San Francisco. That could have been, I could be staring at the ocean all day instead of the Great Salt Lake.
This podcast comes to you from Fisherman's Wharf.
That'd be amazing. The sourdough bread. We've got Lion House rolls. What would they have been? Chowder? Lion House chowder? So many things would be different. So what happens next becomes a thing of hotly debated Wild West legend and lore. The wildly held story is that Sam Brannon apostatized out west but still uses his position as Mormon leader to swindle the saints. Here comes the murky part. What actually happened between Brannon and the Mormons from this point is somewhat of a mystery. Some people said it started to canker because of distance and the worldliness of Gentile fur traders creeping in. Others say Brannon might have simply lacked faith. I'm going with the column C option, in that things are a little more complicated. Oh, did I say complicated? I mean C for crazy, because Shiz is about to get G-O-L-D-F-E-V-E-R up in here. Within a few months of Mormon arrival, gold would be discovered at Sutter's Fort, just upriver from Brannon and his pious Mormon elders.
Oh, that's the land for me. Yeah!
And isn't that always how it is? Things are fine and mellow until the filthy lucre gets in the way. There's a lady who's sure all that glitters gets in the way of the kingdom of heaven.
A good rule of thumb is all gold is wicked gold, unless it's Nephite gold. Write that in your scriptures and stick it.
As a stockholder in the Dream Mine, I resent that statement. We're different. Ah, yes, here we go. The good old gold rush of the American West. Some say James Marshall was the first to discover gold at Coloma while working for John Souter, January 24th, 1848. But the real gold rush really came on May 12th, 1848, when Brother Brannon, now also conveniently at Souter's Fort, stepped off a boat at Sacramento Harbor, parading around a little bottle full of gold dust and shouting, "Gold! Gold! Gold!" from the American River. Is that okay? I've been working on my grizzled prospector voice.
It's perfect. And I actually think Sam Brannon, and we should have sent W.W. Phelps to do the job. He would have made it a lot more interesting. Gold, gold, gold from the American River. That's how you kick off the gold rush? Really, guys?
House on wheels. That's what you want.
It would be, yeah, I mean, he would be dressed for the part and everything. If you're thinking, that's right, Mormons can take credit for everything, including the gold rush, Brian isn't joking. There is historical debate on whether or not James Marshall or Sam Brannon is responsible for kicking off the gold rush. My money, gold dust, is on Brannon, because I'm a loyal saint and we back our own. Until we don't. Or until one loses the faith, takes 250 Mormons to the edges of the earth, and then forgets to check in with the prophet. A true lazy learner, you might say.
Yeah, there's a reason Brannon isn't the last name on most of your Mormon wedding invites taped to your fridge right now. And that story becomes as wild as the West itself. But you're going to have to wait until next episode when we talk about Brigham and Brannon, brother v. brother.
Zion against Zion.
So send avenging angels, brother Brigham, brother Young. Won't you send destroying Danites, brother Young? Spill my blood upon the earth, oh brother Brigham, brother Young. I beg you, spill my blood, oh brother Young. And let it smoke ascend to heaven, brother Brigham, brother Young. And let my breast be cut asunder, brother Young. As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, brother Young. A blood atoning for my sinning, brother Young. Cause I sinned so gravely, brother Brigham, brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, brother Young.
The song we've heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.
Hi, I'm Stephen Carter, the host of the Sunstone Podcast. As I've looked through the names of people who have donated so generously to Sunstone during the past years, I've noticed something unique about them. They tend to use Mormonism as a gin spike, which, I know, sounds like an alcoholic drink, but it's actually more interesting than that. See, one day, probably 20 years ago, I was out in rural Wyoming helping my father-in-law, Ross, do some surveying. Being the strong hunk of man I am, I was assigned to hold the reflector while Ross handled the theodolite. We were surveying near a county road, and at one point, we had to put down a marker in the middle of that road. So Ross takes out a 5-inch metal spike and pounds it into the asphalt with a hammer. Pretty tough spike, I said. They tend to be, Ross told me. They have to live 2 lives. He pulled another spike out of his truck and he handed it to me. I looked at it closely and I saw that it wasn't just a spike. Its head tapered toward the middle, like a flat-top pyramid. And it looked like a gear. The spike itself had a kind of sawtooth on both sides. It's called a gin spike, Ross said. They start out as part of a cotton picker, but eventually they wear out. But surveyors found a use for them. You can pound them into asphalt, and those teeth on the side will keep it in. The tapered head makes sure that nothing like a snowplow gets hung up on it. And the fact that it's magnetic makes it really easy to find. It's the perfect semi-permanent surveying marker. Most people at Sunstone have gone through a faith crisis where either Mormonism doesn't seem to fit them anymore, or they don't seem to fit Mormonism. It's like the gin spike that wears out. But a lot of Sunstoners have found creative ways to make use of that gin spike, even if it was on the junk pile for a while. They claim Mormonism in their own way, doing something unique and useful with it. I'm grateful that I've been able to interact with these people so much during the past years. They were there when I needed someone to help me work through my own faith crisis. I love to meet back up with them at Sunstone conferences. I love to read their words in the magazine and online. And each year, they're also the ones who donate to Sunstone. See, Sunstone only covers its event and publication costs with registration fees and subscriptions. Everything else, the rent, the electricity, insurance, salaries, internet hosting fees, and on, are funded exclusively by donations. It's a testament to the goodness of this community that we've had enough funding for more than 4 decades to reach out to Mormons at their most difficult times. Thanks for being such an essential part of that work. As we head into the next year, we'd love to hear from you. We're interested in your thoughts on how we can better serve this generation of seekers. And your donation will go a long way toward helping that vision come to fruition. Get things rolling at sunstone.org/donate.